Hello and welcome to another episode of the P-Risks podcast series. I'm Mark Inkester, a senior associate in the London private equity team, your host for this episode. This podcast focuses on intellectual property, or IP. I'm delighted to be joined today by two colleagues who know a lot about IP, both its use as a driver and register of value for businesses, but also the risks that IP can unexpectedly present. Daryl Fairbairn is an IP counsel in our New York office and has built his career on advising private equity and other clients on their IP-driven transactions around the world, particularly in the life sciences industries as a former research scientist in immunogenetics. Joining Daryl is Stephen Rees, an IP partner in our London office who also co-heads our global IP practice. Stephen advises clients on their IP strategies, risks, and acquisitions, and has worked across multiple sectors from the fast-moving consumer goods sector through to pharmaceuticals, medical devices, software, and defense. Stephen and Daryl, welcome to this podcast. It's great to have you both here. To start us off, Stephen, why does a sponsor need to think about IP when executing M&A transactions?
First of all, does the business own what it thinks and says it owns? For registered rights, that may be easier to determine because you can go and look at the register and check proprietorship details. Although, as with IP, it isn't always conclusive, as sometimes those records are not always updated. Unregistered rights, like copyrights and trade secrets, they're the more challenging areas to look at because you really have to go back to who created the rights and follow the chain of ownership. And for that, you really need some time to do some detective work into that history. Another area of complication around ownership is joint ownership, and most IP lawyers normally try and walk you away from joint ownership unless you really have to go with it, and that's because of the additional layers of complexity. What can each joint owner do? And also, is because IP is jurisdictional, the rules are different in each geography. The other one I find really interesting is with founder-based businesses. Often a founder's created something, an innovation, and they treat that as their baby. And they will often forget or intentionally not assign the IP into the corporate vehicle. And so that's clearly an important factor on any investment. Not only does that throw up a tax issue for the founder, but also it can present an issue for the investor because we want to make sure the IP is sitting in the right vehicle.
Stephen, completely agree with you on joint ownership. Absolutely don't like it. Following on from your ownership point, thinking about encumbrances, everyone's familiar with mortgages and other financial liens, etc. But for IP, there are other encumbrances that can materially impact the value or the basis that's driving value. For example, licenses to the IP. Licenses can be the primary business source of revenue with royalty and licensing income from third-party licensees. Remember, IP is not a thing that you own. That's technology, and it's different. IP is the right to stop someone else from doing something. And so licenses are an encumbrance on that IP because they limit the ability of the IP owner to stop others from doing the thing that's covered by the IP. There are more exotic flavors too, such as coexistence arrangements and non-assert agreements, which are quasi-licenses but can have some unintentional consequences in PE deals.
Thanks, Stephen and Daryl. That's really helped us set the scene and set out some of the key IP considerations for our sponsor clients. To take a specific scenario that we sometimes encounter on P transactions, sometimes you find out that the target is involved in litigation over IP rights at the time of the transaction. How should a sponsor think about treating these cases?
I think it's fair to say that not all litigation is bad. And so I think it's important to understand, is that sort of offensive or defensive types of litigation? So there are also some sectors and businesses where IP litigation is part of their business plan. So if you take sectors like telecoms or pharmaceuticals, life sciences, both of those are heavily dependent on technologies protected by IP, and they use IP to preserve their monopolies. So litigation is an inherent part of it. So really, I think if you encounter litigation, it's getting to understand what the purpose or the strategy is behind it. Of course, understanding what the impact will be on revenues and costs and the likelihood of success, but thinking what the outcome is, what is it trying to, looking to strive to deliver. And, you know, for example, if the target is involved in lots of litigations, it could be a sign, actually, that there are others trying to jump on the bandwagon because their technology is really successful. But then that has a question mark over the valuation and perhaps longevity of the business or its technology. Will it remain the gold standard or standout star, or are there other investments you need to make, not only to fund that litigation, but also to further innovate and differentiate itself again?
Just a couple of quick points that are unique to you to IP law, which have really important implications on structuring a deal. First, you need to make sure that you don't do anything in your structuring to give the court the basis to dismiss a case because the IP is owned by the wrong entity. Second, you need to make sure that your structuring doesn't do anything to remove a remedy. One really important remedy in IP cases is lost profits. And there are rules and limitations on which entity can have access to those remedies. And the last one relates to privilege and the execution of a deal. It's important when sharing privileged information in the context of a deal not to destroy privilege with respect to IP infringement opinions.
Thanks both. And I think that's really helpful guidance on how to think about IP litigation that we may have identified in our due diligence. Another important consideration for our PE clients is the regulatory landscape in which a target operates. Can you perhaps talk about how government regulations impact the ability of portfolio companies to own, use, and enforce their IP rights?
Yeah, thanks. There are several regulatory regimes that intersect with IP rights that materially impact IP in PE deals. Most commonly, you see antitrust, CFIUS, bankruptcy, export control, crossing paths with IP. The area of focus is different for PE sponsors today than it was in our deals 10 or 20 years ago, and it's constantly shifting. One key area for sponsors to consider today is IP that was created with the support of government-backed funds or pursuant to contracts with government agencies. Funding is often contingent on the government receiving specific rights under any new IP. Three key points here. One, government can take a license. Two, government can retain step-in rights. And three, government funding can also result in a requirement that products manufactured must be made in a specific jurisdiction, which can cause conflict with sponsors' growth plans for executing bolt-ons or its commercial goals of achieving synergies by relocation.
Thanks, Darrell. It's also worthwhile thinking about different regimes in sector-specific arrangements. So if you take the pharma and biotech market as an example, there are further layers of protection that can be derived. Quasi-IP rights, if you will, and they can be used to also help prevent barriers to entry. So the first would be supplementary protection certificates, as an example, which in the field of pharmaceuticals and biologic products offer you an extended period of exclusivity beyond the expiry of a patent, which are designed effectively to compensate the innovator for the time taken to get the medicine to market whilst their patent life has expired. In addition, you've got data exclusivity regimes that you may well have heard of. So these are regimes that prevent or delay the regulator's ability to consider or even approve certain marketing applications for generic versions of the originator product. You'll have heard about in Europe the sort of 8+2+1 model that's currently being debated. But you've also got different regimes in other markets. The US, for example, has different time arrangements depending on whether it's a small molecule drug or a biologic product. And then you've got further regimes on top, such as orphan designations for very rare disease indications, and also incentives for pediatric development of medicines as well.
Thanks, Stephen and Darrell. Those are all really interesting points, and it's clearly an area where we need to ensure our PE clients are aware of any developments. As a final question, how does investing in different industries such as tech or pharma impact the IP issues that a sponsor needs to think about?
Thanks, Mark. Maybe if I take the tech point, and I'm going to focus here around software and open source. So open source software, sort of public domain software, it's now an everyday necessary commonplace use as part of coding. But it's important to understand it's not just that it's free software, but it comes with a spectrum of encumbrances and implications for your own proprietary code. And that's because there's a whole variety of licenses that apply to different types of open source software. And they're all ultimately licenses, and so they have license terms. And you have at sort of one end of the spectrum the very, should we say, easy, permissive licenses that run all the way down the other end of the spectrum and implement provisions that are often referred to as hard copyleft provisions. And what they do is they sort of enable copyright and use copyright to make sure that any derivatives of that open source software, whether you've modified it or even in some circumstances you implement it into your own proprietary code, it takes that derivative work and requires that to be put back into the open source community and therefore made available for future users and developers who can go off and further develop it. So it's really important to understand how open source is impacting proprietary code, particularly if that's a key asset or a key value driver for the business, because you may be losing some proprietary advantage and also some value.
In biotech and pharma deals, my favorite issue is how to deal with new IP whenever new drugs or diagnostic tools are created. This has some implications for PE sponsors and its diligence. So how do the development contracts of the target allocate ownership and use rights? And also in deal structuring, both in planning for acquisition and exit strategies and in deal execution for transitional long-term arrangements. The technical problem is that the rules for patents are different from copyrights, or different from trade secrets, and different from trademarks. Plus the rules differ from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, so the issues get really complex really fast. For PE owners of biotech and pharma companies, getting the issue of new IP right means building and preserving portfolio company value and better outcomes at exit, whether by IPO or spinoff or trade sale or disposal to another PE sponsor.
Stephen, Daryl, thank you both for such an interesting discussion, which leaves us with a lot to think about. To our listeners, thank you for listening, and please don't hesitate to reach out to us if you have any questions. If you'd like to find out about other episodes in this series, please visit the Clifford Chance PE Risks website. Thank you.